Welcome back to part three of our episode, The Dangerous Lives of Black Children. I'm Hannah Stanley, host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. Please take a moment and hit subscribe so you don't miss a moment. Joining us now is Elena Quintana, director of Adler's Institute on Public Safety and Social Justice. Elena, thank you so much for coming back and joining me yet again for one of our podcasts.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Now, Nataka and Ben, who are on the show, talk about this time as the age of mass incarceration, and where the time that we are living now as the age of mass incarceration. Can you define that and explain a little bit how that happened?
So between 1980 and 2008, basically, we went from 500,000 people being incarcerated in the United States to 2.3 million people being incarcerated. So it just shot up like a rocket. And that is thanks to a tough on crime campaign that took place in that period of time, including the war on drugs. And I think that those two things, all of the tough on crime, war on drugs, all those things colluded to really basically hurt badly, devastate in some cases, many communities of color and lock up millions of citizens that really could do better getting treatment or other forms of service. Now we have a lot and lots, like millions of people, not just who are incarcerated, but also millions more who are on some form of supervision, such as electronic monitoring, parole, probation.
We've talked about this on a different episode of this podcast and how that affects the community as a whole. But talk to me a little bit, if you would, and talk to all of us about the how disproportionate it is. It's not just a full, thorough blend of our cultures in prison.
Absolutely not. So 1 in 6 black men has been incarcerated as of 2001. That's an NAACP figure. 1 in 3 black children born can expect to serve some time in prison. And in Chicago, it's even worse. It's 1 in 2. So we are, in terms of like who gets arrested, who becomes court involved, it is so disproportionate that it makes a mockery of justice.
When you were at the Chicago Police Academy, tell me a little bit about the story of the drug arrests, how they would talk about the drug arrests, please.
Well, there was an article that came out when I was teaching a class at the Chicago Police Academy. It was a community psychology class that was taught there. And it was very interesting because it was from a 2011 article called The Grass Gap that came out in The Reader that talked about how even though white people are as likely to use marijuana as black people, that black people are 15 times more likely to be arrested.
15.
And if you look actually at convictions, the gap becomes even more pronounced. And so basically you're looking at across the board. I mean, that's just one article, right? So I was asking some of the people there, like, what is it that makes this more likely, right? Mm-hmm. And they're saying, well, you know, if we consider it for personal use, we don't want to mess up somebody's life who's professional and probably just like, you know, using marijuana for personal use. But if somebody as a young person, especially a young person of color, has the same amount split up in multiple baggies, they're more likely to get picked up, even if it's the same exact amount. So that's just one example of how especially African-Americans, to a lesser extent Latinos, are more likely to be arrested, more likely to be charged for more serious charges. They're more likely to be convicted. They're more likely to serve longer sentences. Just across the board with the criminal justice system, African Americans pay the highest price.
So when we hear those numbers, you immediately draw, well, I do, I draw the conclusion that criminal justice, our system at currently, is at some degree racist.
Yes.
So how do we fix this? This is always my question. How do we make it better?
How do we, well, there's lots of ways that make it better. I think that we need to be honest about what's going on. I really am thankful. Just a couple days ago, John Ehrlichman, who was a policy chief under the Nixon administration, talked about how the war on drugs was absolutely aimed at African Americans and hippies, but mostly African Americans, right? Yeah. And so the fact that he came forward and just said what we see, that it was designed to do this. I mean, it's very interesting because so many people say, you're playing the race card. Well, the race card that's actually being played is by systems. Schools, prisons, like all of these, you know, there's lots of kinds of large governmental decisions that can be made around housing, education, daycare, like all criminal justice, obviously, that are so unequal that basically push especially African Americans into the criminal justice system as the only means of intervention if there's any problem. So there's lots of systems that collude to make sure that African Americans have more problems and obstacles than the average person, and especially compared to whites. But then the only intervention available to them is often a criminal justice intervention. So they become criminalized rather than treated, and they're re-traumatized rather than really being understood and given options and opportunities equal to that other people have. So according to a couple of different studies by University of Chicago in 2003, as well as Arizona State in 2014, they found that black people with a clean record, no criminal record, had a harder time getting a job than a white person with a criminal record.
That's so hard to understand. And this only leads us to more problems down the road, because we're still having groups of people be in the same. Unemployment is higher, and then they react because of unemployment, and we go into this again vicious cycle.
Right.
I don't think I've ever said vicious cycle more than I have in this past hour.
Yes.
So when we, because we have this man, the man who just came out and said that the war on drugs was absolutely
John Ehrlichman.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. To paraphrase, racist, and that it was designed to incarcerate black men and hippies. We want to always make sure the hippies are included, not excluded. But how can we move forward, because there is now this cycle that we're involved in? What are the first steps to break the cycle, move forward, and stop some of this systemic issues?
One of the things I think is a response I don't like to see is people giving small amounts of charity to African Americans or African American communities. What I really want to see is a response that demands justice, which is a wide... I'm not African American. I'm so offended by the fact of all of these injustices, and that African Americans are paying disproportionately to an obscene extent, and that there have been actual policies, not just slavery and Jim Crow, but also redlining, that basically make it difficult for African Americans to buy houses and get equity in their houses and be able to sell for the same amount that they paid, or the war on drugs and then mass incarceration. All of these things that's the actual race card, like that's enacted, right? And it's really happening at the highest levels of our society. Like, government has put these policies into place. And as a society, we need to all be outraged and not turn a blind eye and think that, oh, bad things just happen to bad people. That's not what's happening here. And so it's important to really fight for true justice and fairness, for an opportunity to work, live, thrive, be educated in a way that's equal to what any white person wants. Mm-hmm. African Americans, other people of color, deserve the same thing. And in fact, when we really try to make justice occur, healing occurs even for white people, because it's not a healthy thing for there to be these huge disparities. It sickens all of us, and we should all reject it.
The one that most affects me, and I've discussed this a couple of times with my husband, because it's women get paid less. That's kind of this. It's such the standard that none of us are even. Everybody's nodding their head. Yes, that is true. We do. And I've told my husband, I said, I'm afraid that it's only going to change once we have women who are in the right positions to make sure that it's equal. Is that the same? One, I might be off base about that, but is that a similar mindset? Are we going to have to wait until this generationally stops? I know you said we need outrage, and that's good, but we still, this is something that's going to take time. Is it a generational time, or is this like a decade kind of time? Are there things we can do that will expedite that?
Absolutely. I think that groups like BYP 100 and Black Lives Matter have been really proactive in lifting agendas that are saying we need to change policing policies. And guess what? We do. That would be an enormous step toward a better society where, you know, we are able to not actively criminalize African Americans across the board. We also need to reinvest in communities that have suffered a scourge of mass incarceration. Many communities have such an enormous investment in places downstate, prisons downstate, that there's not mental health services, daycare services, recreational services, tutoring services that you see in abundant supply in certain northern suburbs. Mm-hmm. And even, like, say, for example, the majority of young people that go to Chicago public schools are people of color. And yet, and they pay about, it's about roughly $4,500, $5,000 per pupil per year, right? That's what the budget is. In the suburbs, it's $20,000, right? You go to Evanston, it's $20,000. It might be $23,000 in Niles. I mean, it's, you know, four times more to educate children. And so basically, we are divesting from things that really help equalize opportunity for people, and we are investing them all in prisons.
And because these communities are poorer, where we're having a lot of these, mm-hmm. And I guess to some degree, why wouldn't they be? Because they're losing a breadwinner because they're incarcerated, and then they have a single parent or multiple generations who need to live together to help support, to create that community, the village that it takes to raise a child. Do these people and these areas then have less political representation?
Yes. I mean, absolutely. When you have disorganization and you have that much disruption caused by picking people out and incarcerating them rather than treating them perhaps, or giving them opportunities like employment and keeping families together and helping struggling families to strengthen and their bonds and their functioning. I mean, that's what's really needed right now, is a holistic investment, reinvestment into communities that are struggling so that they can become healthier. And what we see is when justice is kind of, when justice is basically an option for people, mm-hmm. communities get healthier quickly. It's so interesting. And you see this. I mean, I've given an example of, for example, there was a study done by somebody at Princeton who was looking at the incredible suicide rates of in gay and bisexual men. And he did this study in Boston, and he was looking at a clinic that really looked at the high suicide rates, particularly for LGBT people in that area, at a clinic that specialized in mental health care for them. And in the middle of his two-year study, gay marriage was legalized. It was the first state to legalize gay marriage. And there was this enormous increase in terms of fewer sicknesses, like in terms of hospital visits, medication that was given, suicidal ideation, like there was this enormous drop in terms of symptomatic behavior, right? Because people were validated and given more access to be equality, basically, equal access to justice, right? I really think that health and healing comes quickly when justice is actuated. Like, we need it to happen in order for people to be able to get healthier.
And referring back to what Nataka said in our second segment, and if you missed it, I invite you to go back. It was incredibly compelling and just incredibly powerful knowledge to me, and I'm sure to many of you as well. But she referred to Maslow and the hierarchy of needs and the sense of belonging and having that reciprocated. So having gay marriage be approved gave them the feeling that they were belonging and they were a part of the community and they were no longer different. They could do what everyone else could do. So if this is something that we are able to then extend across a very different line to some of these communities and that part of our culture, it seems like, as you said, those changes could be fast and furious.
Absolutely right. I mean, people who are able to fulfill their own human potential are going to not be out there like doing illegal things or harming other people when they have access to positive, hope for their future and hope for their children and hope for their families.
This has been an incredibly powerful three segments. If you, again, have missed any of it, one, take a moment to subscribe so that does not happen in the future. But then also, please go back and check out both Benton and Nataka, our guests, in segments one and two. And Elena, thank you so much for your time today, again, being a guest on this podcast. This is going to conclude today's program. Join us next week for our episode on fixing public policy, which is what I try to do on every episode anyway. I'm Hannah Stanley, and this is On Social Health and Change, presented by Adler University. And again, please make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Have a great day.